Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about evangelicals' elite problem.
Hi, welcome to the podcast today. No snacks, just me and Dusty and Chris.
Hey, real quick, Chris, when you leave us, are you going to send snacks?
I should send some snacks. I can get some shout out. I can feel like I'm still part of the...
Yeah, I don't know why you wouldn't.
Everything.
At least a couple times a year.
I got to send in. Yes, that's a good call, Dusty.
Meanwhile, other people can.
That's right. We're going to talk today about an article that makes me cranky.
I love it when we get Bob cranky with the articles we recommend.
It's a piece in the January 2026 issue of First Things by Aaron Wren, called The Problem with the Evangelical Elite. I have so many disagreements with this piece. There's so many places where it just made me angry. I'm going to try to summarize it super briefly and quickly. You can, you know, we'll link to it if you want to go read to it. Sometimes First Things puts their stuff behind a paywall, but I think they give you a few free views before you have to give them an email address. But it's about a 4 or 5 page article in First Things. Aaron Wren is basically arguing, hey, evangelicals don't have any cultural elites. I'll read the first paragraph of the article. The problem with the evangelical elite is that there isn't one. All too few evangelical Christians hold senior positions in the culture-shaping domains of American society. Evangelicals don't run movie studios or serve as editors-in-chief of major newspapers or as presidents of elite universities. There are no evangelicals on the Supreme Court. There are hardly any leading evangelical academics or artists. There are few evangelicals at the commanding heights of finance. The prominent evangelicals in Silicon Valley can be counted on one hand. You get the point. He's saying, hey, you know what? Evangelicals are not well represented in what he calls the culture-shaping domains of American society. And what's interesting to me about this piece, so he goes on to basically write a whole article about, hey, you know, does that matter? And if so, what should we do about it? That's kind of the way he frames articles. First of all, does it matter or not whether we have people in these elite areas? And then two, if it does matter, how could we go about getting back into those spaces? First of all, I disagree with his hypothesis.
Say more.
But second, I just don't know what, I feel like I read this whole article not really understanding what he means by the word elite, because he just never really defines it. The best thing he does is senior positions in the culture-shaping domains of American society. So he goes on to list movies, newspapers, you know, Supreme Court, whatever. Okay, great. I think he's picking and choosing the domains that actually don't have evangelicals, because I think, well, I could easily list a bunch of other domains where evangelicals are actually pretty well represented. And so it's just odd to me that anytime I always want to know, like, what does it mean to be an elite, quote unquote? Like, Mako Fujimura is arguably one of the most elite artists in the United States of America, and he's a convictional evangelical Christian. My uncle is
I've heard of
Senate
him.
Majority Leader. Yeah. Mike Johnson, who is the Speaker of the House, is an evangelical. Russell Vaught, who runs the Office of Management and Budget in the Trump administration, isn't he? Like, I could go on. Like, there's actually tons of evangelicals in significant places of influence in our culture. So it feels to me like Aaron Wren wanted to pitch an article to First Things, and First Things was like, cool, that sounds like a good piece. I don't know. I have cynicism about, is there actually a problem here, or is it just a problem of Aaron Wren's own making?
Yeah. The thing that was interesting to me too is he identifies some of these cultural institutions, and could there ever be some of it's like, so movie studios, like, are we could put all the structures in place to raise up elites. Are we ever going to place an evangelical at the head of a major movie studio?
Yeah, like, probably not.
So some of the pieces of this of like, I just don't think there are some cultural institutions that have become their character has become such that evangelicals are never going to occupy those spaces. And we shouldn't, I don't think that's necessarily a problem.
I would say, and they're not even going to be allowed to occupy those spaces.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no,
let's remember, yeah. Sorry, Chris, I didn't mean to interrupt. Russell Vaught, who's a very qualify. I mean, I realize not everybody in the Trump administration is highly qualified for the roles they're in, but Russell Vought is a person who is. He's the head of the Office of Management and Budget. He's a graduate of Wheaton College. When he was appointed to that role a year ago, Wheaton College congratulated him on their Facebook page and then had to take down their congratulation because so many people were like, "Whoa, you can't congratulate that guy because he's working for Trump." He's like, your point is well taken, meaning as soon as an evangelical elite rises to a position, we're like, oh, that guy actually has some authority. Now we're all mad at him because, well, he's working for the wrong person, or gosh, you know, I don't like the way they're doing things. It just, it's a lose-lose here, it feels like.
Yeah, and he actually points that out as far as what evangelicals do to each other is, because evangelicalism can be very individualized and have its own sort of camps within the broader camp, and we start attacking each other, where he makes the point, like, if you look at those who identify as Catholics, like the high, like, level elites within Catholicism don't attack others. There's not, it's just like they'll go at each other, kind of they'll punch sideways or punch up. There's never punching down. And so we're very good, evangelicals are very good at criticizing those who get placed in elite positions because of our populist fervor.
I do think that's a problem. I agree. And he's good to name that, because evangelicals do like to eat their own. They there's like this thing where we like, if you're too cool, if you're too appreciated and accepted by the society, you must have sold out. There's this weird thing, that this populism within the evangelical tradition that does do that. But I was fascinated, Chris. So the title of this article by Aaron Wren is "The Problem with the Evangelical Elite." Would you read the title of this article from a year ago?
"The Scandal of Compromising Evangelical Elites."
This is a piece by Andrew Walker at World Magazine, where he basically says, too many high status Christians crave acceptance more than they embody conviction. So he's writing an article about, well, actually the problem with elites is once they get to those places, they stop being good Christians. And I'm just like, well, pick which article you want to talk about. Is it that we don't have enough of them, or is it that we do have them, they're just squishy? Like, they're
Well, I think you could also make an argument, though, that to be an influential Christian, you can't be an elite. You actually have to be subversive. Right?
Yeah, you're not going to be able to operate in some of these spaces. You're just not.
Yeah. I mean, you could say Billy Graham was.
Well, but here's,
you say Billy Graham was an elite.
Yes, but here's the problem. Aaron Wren is going to say he's not going to let you use that category, because his claim is when evangelicals name their elites, it's always pastors and theologians and authors. It's people within ministry world.
Yeah.
And he wants to say, but the CEO of BlackRock is not an evangelical, and Google doesn't. You know, it's just, he wants to name the influential companies and sectors of society and ask, are there evangelicals in those places? And, you know, again, I think he's a little picking and choosing his, you know, the thing that makes the case he wants to make. But setting that aside for a minute, let's just take for granted at least one of the things he says, Chris, seems to have some merit, which is evangelicals are well represented in American society. There's a large chunk of America who would claim to be evangelical Christians, but we're not necessarily well represented in sort of elite leadership positions. And that seems to be a fair observation.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you compare, in fact, James Davison Hunter makes this same observation in his book To Change the World, which is 15 years old now. But he said Jewish people make up like 3% of the population. But you think about how many key actors and writers and, like, you know, people like David Brooks, you know, are your favorite comedians, you know, Ben Stiller, people like that. You think about all the people who are Jewish who do occupy positions of influence. And one of the points Hunter is making is it seems disproportionate. It seems like for the number of Americans who are evangelical, they ought to be more well represented in those places. And so that's a fair observation.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to consider why. I mean, and I think that's one of the wrestles I had with the article is why.
You always say wrestles. Why do you say that?
Because I don't know.
Don't want to say you disagree.
I don't know if I have clear thoughts.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You're still actually wrestling. I just disagree with the article. I just think it's wrong.
Just more punch.
Yeah. But if so what would you say with that discrepancy between the percentage of the populace versus how it's represented in elite spaces, like why the discrepancy?
Three things Wren names that I think are true, and then a few that I think he just misses on. The three that are true is, one, what you said, that evangelicals are skeptical of power, position, influence. And so there's a populist strain that sort of pushes against that. The second thing I think he says that's true is we have an underdeveloped theology of vocation. And so evangelicals kind of are about getting people saved and getting them to heaven, but we haven't done great work in the theology of vocation. He mentions Keller's book, Every Good Endeavor, as being sort of like the one good contribution to move that conversation forward, but that there needs to be more work done there. And then the third thing he mentions is that we lack what he calls patronage networks. We lack, you know, ways to support and encourage people who say want to be a Supreme Court justice in the future. That's a good example to me. It's like, okay, if you have a young up and coming evangelical law student in your church who, you know, thinks, hey, I'd like to get on the Supreme Court when I'm 50. What are we going to do with that person? There, you know, his point, I guess, is that like in Catholicism, there actually are kind of like funding networks and training networks and ways to sort of help that person move forward in their vocation. And evangelicalism kind of lacks that. So those are the three things I would say. I think those are fair points, that there's a populist impulse that works against it, that there's not a strong theology of vocation, and that we lack sort of a commitment to patronage. I don't know. Do you feel like those?
No, those all resonate. I think the vocation one too, and before we started recording, I made the comment of, I don't know if evangelicals have a well thought out theology of ambition and desire. Yeah. And it's like faithfulness, which is good, and humility. And even the book, Keller's book of wanting to be redemptive in your work and have bigger purpose in your work, but not a lot on, hey, if someone wants to achieve, because to be elite, you've got to want to achieve a unique status.
Yes.
And I think that gets looked at skeptically in a lot of evangelical spaces too.
It's like, well, you should be humble.
Yeah. If I want to be, I mean, the one place that it's not, like, there's a couple of places, but one of the places it's not is sports, which is interesting.
Yeah. Like, well, but hey, but that's another point I wanted to make is like, okay, there's a sector of society where you think about people like Tony Dungy. Think about like how many
Tebow.
Yeah. How many head coaches, how many commentators, how many sports adjacent people are evangelical? There's actually a ton of them.
And it seems like every college football player star that gets interviewed starts with thanking Jesus.
Like, sorry, that's a little bit of a tangent. I'm just saying that's athletics is an example of one spot where you're like, actually, evangelicals are well represented. And that is an elite domain of society because you have to be very good at what you do to get there. To your broader point, Chris, I think you are exactly right that we aren't quite sure what to do with ambition. So let's come back to that in a minute, because I think that's an important conversation point that this article does raise. I want to first mention what I disagree with Wren. And he's basically, it's around this idea of patronage. And he basically says, whereas Catholicism, I'll read from the article now, whereas Catholicism enjoys a network of interlocking academic programs, activist organizations, and funders, there is no patronage or intellectual ecosystem for evangelicals within, for instance, Washington's establishment. I'm just not sure that's true. I just think, well, do we have the strength there that the Catholic tradition does? Probably not. But actually, I think there are plenty of people who want to push good, competent evangelical Christians forward in various sectors of society. In other words, to go back to the podcast of last week, I don't think it's true that like if you're an evangelical, somebody's just gonna be like, well, there's no future for you here. I actually think there are, within all kinds of streams of society, good patronage networks and mentorship networks for evangelicals who want to be excellent at their vocation. Do you think that's true or not?
I took his point to be that it's not unified in the same way the Catholic Church is.
Yeah, right.
Where,
oh gosh, what do you? I'm going to make you substantiate your claim
that the Catholic Church is more, but because evangelical has you have the broad umbrella, but then you have just these various pockets that maybe they're friendly with each other and they all kind of claim evangelical beliefs and goals. But the Catholic Church, it's more connected under a single umbrella of the Catholic Church. And so that networking is tighter in some ways and more unified and coherent, where the evangelical ones are going to be a bit scattered. Okay. That's the point I took.
And there's, I did too. And there's more funding there too. Like there's definitely old money.
Well, you know, because you and I have both been part of a school that tries to raise money. And we somehow, Catholic private schools are so good at fundraising.
Yeah, because there's actually, it's tied to my spirituality in the Catholic Church.
A deeper idea.
Well, and there's just sort of this like, there is a sort of like this is part of what we do is like we build institutions, and Protestants are less institution building is what you might be saying. But I think where I felt frustrated with Wren in this article is that where he lands is to say, Chris, the way to get some evangelical elites, the way for us to solve this problem is to make common cause with mainline Protestantism.
That was an interesting point.
That, you know, actually, if we just like would join the PCUSA or like be good Episcopalians, that he seems to have this weird, I would call it like romanticized vision of WASP, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. You know, it's like he thinks we're living in the middle of the 20th century where like the Protestant ecosystem is really robust. And I underlined this line where he says, he's talking about cross-fertilization between like mainline Protestantism and evangelicals. And I think his point is like the oldest and most historic churches in any given city are probably Anglican, you know, Presbyterian. They're these sort of older denominational structures. And so what evangelicals should do is sort of like partner with those more institutionally hefty Protestant establishments. But he says, this requires an openness to collaborating on the basis of a shared theological traditionalism. That is, agreement on such essentials of the faith as the Nicene Creed, the centrality of the gospel, and the Christian moral framework. And I underlined that and said, that's exactly what the mainline has jettisoned. They don't have the Christian moral framework. They've all gone open and affirming on sexual ethics, yep, and really kind of have abandoned even the centrality of salvation by faith alone in many cases. And so it's funny to me that he just imagines that, like, you know who's going to get behind the evangelicals is all those mainline Protestants out there that just wish they had some cultural credibility back. And what they should do is like prop up the local evangelical elite. And I just think I know so many stories of good gospel believing people who were in more mainline or liberally kinds of churches and just, they got shut down because they were conservative. Yeah. The reason they did not get advanced is, well, I mean, you kind of hold to a traditional sexual ethic and that's just not going to go anywhere here. I mean, I can tell you stories. Yeah. This happens all the time.
Right.
Yeah. That I think is one of the things that he doesn't do enough in this article to highlight the barring, there are things that, yeah, evangelicals can do better to around maybe ambition, vocation, various things, but that doesn't guarantee anything. When you consider that in a lot of these institutions and a lot of these cultural spaces, being evangelical is a liability.
Exactly.
If you in any way, shape or form come across that you hold to a traditional biblical standard of sexuality, oh, it's a non-starter. It's a complete non-starter.
Yeah.
So there are ways in just where we are as a culture that these things have been captured. And that's why you do see some evangelicals trying to create new institutions. And, you know, the movie studio one. Yeah, Angel Studios is not Paramount, you know. So, and we can make fun of kind of the quality of some Christian, you know, movies and TV shows and stuff. But it seems to be there's an attempt to try to improve it. Like The Chosen is a good example.
The Chosen is a really good, well-made movie.
There is attempts to create these and new sort of institutions and create these. Yeah. And it's a cultural movement too. I mean, The Chosen has swept the nation. I mean, it's not just some little like niche TV show like you just watch on YouTube. So there are Christians trying to do the kind of work that pushes into these spaces. And so acknowledging that a bit more, but then also acknowledging some of the challenges to, even if we have some of the right mechanics, for lack of a better term, we're still going to run into problems.
You know that Angel Studio has broken into the culture a little bit when my barber, who's not a Christian, is mentioning it to me. Yeah. That's when we know. Okay, so bring it back for me, pastors. What do I do if I'm a young, let's just say I'm a young 20-something male or female in your church, and I'm coming to you saying like, hey, I want to be on the Senate floor. What do you do with my ambition?
Well, that's good. Let's go back to the conversation about ambition, because I think this is good. Number one, we have to learn. It sounds like what you were saying, Chris, is like we have to learn to honor ambition.
Yeah.
To call it good.
Yeah. To not be afraid of people that want to achieve high level things.
And what's funny is, like you said, we generally are great with that if they want to be in sports.
Yeah.
We like elite.
One space. Yeah.
Evangelicals are fine with people that want to get drafted into the NFL, but not so much if you want to be on the Senate
floor. Or in ministry. We're okay with it if you desire a noble task.
Yeah. Because to be in high level politics or high level finance or whatever, you have to be the type of leader that embraces power and embraces changing things and moving people and have a command that, again, we don't always have, we're not always comfortable with.
Hang I thought on. Power was bad.
Yeah, you're talking about two things. So ambition and power. I want to talk about both. Ambition is that internal drive to be great. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying is we need to empower that more than we do. So to go back to your question, Dusty, I do think there are young people, young leaders, middle-aged leaders even, within a lot of our churches that want to be great at what they do. And they ought to find the church as a place that champions their ambition and says, hey, we want to help you be great. But second, that question of how do we relate to power? Because as you said, to be good at something means at some point somebody's going to hand you some power and say, cool, now you're in authority. Now you get to make some judgment calls. Now you get to lead. And for a lot of evangelicals, power is a tense category. We're just not sure how to relate to that. So I think we need a better theology of ambition and a better theology of how do we hold and use power rather than being afraid of it?
So yeah, how do I hold intention that I got to be okay with ambition and power, but as a Christian, I'm looking to Christ who emptied himself.
Well, but I think we make a false dichotomy there humility means taking the low road and emptying myself of power. Actually, humility might mean using power for the good of others, like accepting responsibility. And to go back to your thing about politics, Dusty, okay. I'll tell a story because it's a story I heard. It might be an apocryphal story, but it's a story I've heard that resonates. I know there's a friend of ours in Providence Church in Austin who knew Ben Sasse when Ben Sasse was a college student. And he says, I wasn't there, but he says that Ben Sasse used to come up to him on the campus of Harvard and say, hey, I'm Ben Sasse. I'm running for president in 2024. This is in like 1993, you know, that he just had this ambition of like, I'm going to do great political things. And from the time he was 21 years old, that was just how he, you know, and I think like, so what I want to do with a person like that is to say, great. How can we, if we agree that you have the capacity for that. So sometimes people's ambition outpaces their actual abilities. And so part of the church's job is to say, does your ambition match your abilities? Because I know a lot of people who want to be great at stuff. It's just, I'm actually just going to be average and that's okay. But for people who have high ambition and actually have the capacity and potential to do really great things, I think we sort of want to say, cool, how do we get behind that and help push you forward in whatever vocation it is. But the other thing is that does require nuance. It requires us discipling people to understand how do you work hard at something for 10 or 20 or 30 years to get to the place where you have the role that you're after. Because if you think about like, you know, Aaron Wren mentions serving on the Supreme Court. Well, guess what? You're not getting appointed to the Supreme Court at age 27. You know, you're going to put in a few decades of faithful work in the law profession before you end up on a list of names for the Supreme Court. So we're going to have to help people sort of do that decades long faithfulness in a vocation and excellence in that vocation to get to a place where they're a Ben Sasse or where they're nominated for the Supreme Court or where they're a John Thune or a Mike Johnson or whoever it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Going back to a little bit of a digression here, going back to that theology of power that we don't necessarily have a good one or a unified one. I think that's the thing. Again, one of the things that I've been processing that when he uses the example of like Catholicism, that there's like a Catholic social doctrine. There's a body of thought that has shaped. If you're in the Catholic tradition, kind of operating those spaces that propels you forward into places of position, of power, of ambition. And it seems if he's making the case that evangelicals lack that sort of coherent shaping, like that we might have books, you know, the evangelical guy writes about this evangelical guy writes about this. And not to say within the Catholic tradition, there aren't various views of that, but there's something that institutionally within the Catholic tradition that is unifying, that propels people forward maybe in some ways that doesn't exist in the evangelical church. That's one of the things he writes about that I'm just interested in that, how true that is.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't buy that it's true, but there's something there. He's naming something. It just feels to me like anytime people say things like, the Catholic tradition X. I just want to say, well, which Catholic? Like,
yeah.
Let's not pretend that there's a monolithic,
yeah, super
elite,
important.
You yeah. know, there's like a monolithic track for Catholic elites that just helps them get out ahead. I think
yeah.
there are a lot of good institutions with credibility that help Catholics succeed. You can go get a PhD at Notre Dame and that's going to yeah. open some doors for you, you know, and you can, that's an example.
Yeah. But it is, why can a Catholic university like Notre Dame, I mean, even Creighton here in Omaha, get to a certain status that, you know, Wheaton, Wheaton's probably the top.
Yeah.
If you're talking about evangelical schools.
Yeah, I think so.
But what's keeping Wheaton from stepping even to that gear or that level of notoriety? So that's an interesting thing to me too.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about Wheaton is Billy Graham put it on the map.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of, much of evangelicalism goes back to Billy Graham, you know, in terms of his influence, both, you know, elite and populist. Here's where I want to land. We haven't even talked about all my problems with Aaron Wren's article here, but
we're going to need a whole nother podcast.
We are. We could do three podcasts on this, but here's one interesting thing he acknowledges that I actually appreciate. I was like, hey, this is actually an interesting framing. He says, one of the things that evangelicalism needs is flagship churches. He says, historically, most cities have had a few churches, often large and wealthy, attended by elites. They were once mainline Protestant. Today, most of those congregations are theologically liberal and therefore useless as focal points for an evangelical elite. And so what he's arguing is evangelicals need to build flagship churches in cities. He names a few: Redeemer Pres and Central Pres in New York City, Capitol Hill Baptist in Washington, Highland Park Presbyterian in Dallas, and so forth. So he says, hey, there are some cities that have sort of this flagship Protestant evangelical church from which elites can arise and within which they can find fellowship and community and mentorship and so forth. And I would just say, I think that's an interesting vision. That's actually kind of part of my vision for Coram Deo, is that we would be able to, in a very small city in the U.S., play part of that role of a place where, yeah, people who are culturally excellent at what they do can find a place to connect with other Christians who want to be really good in their vocation. So I think that's an interesting observation, because it does seem that one of the things the Catholic tradition has is, go to any major city in the U.S., there's going to be a huge Catholic cathedral or the church where like everything happens and kind of emanates out of, you know, and that goes back, you know, 300 and 400 years in our international history in most of those cities. And so I think that's an interesting vision for me as a church leader, to say, how can we, without trying to make it like a weird competitive, you know, better than, worse than kind of a thing, but how can we just acknowledge, man, we want there to be flagship churches where highly ambitious evangelicals can find that their ambition is not tamped down, but is pushed forward.
And obviously without losing the gospel.
Yes.
In the same ambition, which you could say the Catholic Church.
Right. Yeah. I would say the Catholic Church
has done that.
Yeah. But, you know, Keller did a great job in New York City building a flagship church that really has sort of like cultivated a context for elite leaders to kind of grow in. I don't even really like the word elite, because I feel like it feels statusy. It feels like a word that just doesn't get at what we're really talking about. Although I guess that's my take on the article is, I think we all know what he means when he says the word elite. Okay, I can kind of get behind what he's saying. But elite, it has a strange connotation, because it feels elitist. Like, for instance, no one would say, I'm an elite corn farmer.
Yeah.
Like, that's just not, there's certain categories where it's like, you might be the best in the world, but we wouldn't use the word elite, because it kind of is a class kind of a
thing. There are class undertones, overtones, subtleties, not so subtle aspects of this too. Because if you're talking about traditional elite, you're also talking about a social class, which comes with an aesthetic and sensibilities. And oftentimes that is generational wealth. And so there's these other dynamics that are in play too, that you can't just go out and just create structures for that. Like, there's more to it than that. But when you do get kind of to the honesty of the class piece of it too, I think that's, those are other complications.
It's interesting also to think about how we don't, you know, we're at this new place, perhaps in history, where on the heels of Charlie Kirk's death last year, you can be outspoken as a Christian, and maybe what Aaron Wren is getting at is like, you can be outspoken like that about your faith and still have prominent influence in some other capacity.
Yeah. And I guess the place where I kind of still feel some angst is just whether the segments of society he is naming are actually the important ones. I guess what I'm saying is like, to me, this whole conversation about elite power and influence might be a boomer conversation. Because if you ask like, is Joe Rogan more influential than CBS News? I would say, yeah, probably. Yeah. But you know, he says, well, you know, evangelicals don't serve as editors of major newspapers. Okay. Well, would you rather like run the New York Times or be Joe Rogan? I would say like, well, like podcasting, new media is kind of a whole new ecosystem, you know? And so it feels to me like, I don't know that the things he is naming as culture shaping institutions hold the way that he wants them to hold.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about America is that it has always been populist in certain ways where it's like, if there's not a path for you in traditional movie studios, you know what you do? You raise money, you start your own angel studios, you know, or if there's not a path for you at the New York Times, you know what you do? You start your own Substack and get yourself 300,000 subscribers. You know, it's just, there are ways that our culture just advantages people who are entrepreneurial. And so there's something about this article that just feels to me like I'm not sure the battle that he's calling us to fight is worth fighting. I'm not sure that like our aim should be like, let's get more evangelical elites in these centers of power. It's like, maybe we should just faithfully preach the gospel, help people pursue their ambitions. And whether their ambition is, I want to be a great electrician and provide for my family, or I want to be on the Supreme Court or the first chair violin of the New York Symphony. Great. You know, like we're going to push people forward and teach them to be Christians in those vocations. I'm just not convinced there's something here worth putting a lot of energy toward, but I want to be careful of my own cynicism.
Possibly maybe the most helpful thing here that he's highlighted is that ambition is not bad.
Yes.
Yeah. And what I hear you guys saying is that's okay. Like you can pursue your thing with excellency in such a way that you want to hold to your Christian faith and be the best first chair, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I want men and women that the ambition for elite, whatever the elite is, whatever, just that's okay. That is okay. And by nature, elite is going to be selective.
Yes. That's the thing.
It's always going to be the way. But for those people who have that gifting that God has given them, the capacity, the opportunities, that's encouraged, that thing is encouraged.
Yep. It's good.
Well, whether you believe there is a problem with the evangelical elite or whether you're skeptical that there is, I hope that call to honor ambition and to understand what it means to use power in a just and good way, I hope that those pieces of our conversation are helpful to you, regardless of whether you find yourself seeking to be the next Supreme Court justice or just the next great neighbor in your neighborhood who loves your neighbors as yourself. Both of those are honoring and glorifying to the Lord Jesus Christ. So thanks for coming along as we engage this article.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners, so if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.